Hello, and welcome to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne here at 88.5 KRFY, Community Radio for North Idaho. I am Dr. Joanne, and I hope you'll enjoy the medical topics that I've chosen to present at 8 a.m. the first Monday of every month. You can also catch the show at 8 a.m. on the third Monday, or if you enjoy podcasts, listen to a podcast of the show on our website, krfy.org, and select the podcast tab. Our show today features August as National Immunization Awareness Month, and I'm very excited to be airing a recorded interview with Dr. Michael Osterholm, nationally recognized epidemiologist from the University of Minnesota Center for Infectious Disease and Policy, known as CDRAP. Just a little background on National Immunization Awareness Month, as recognized by the CDC, Center for Disease Control, and the AAP, the American Association of Pediatrics. As we head back to school and respiratory virus season, it's so very important that people of all ages are up to date on their vaccines. Physicians want to raise awareness of the importance of vaccines and encourage everyone to speak to a healthcare provider they trust. As the 2024 president of the AAP, Ben Hoffman, noted, pediatricians have only one mission: to protect the well-being of all children. As a person who grew up in the 40s through the 60s, went to medical school, served a pediatric residency, and continued into pediatric practice, I saw firsthand many of the diseases that are now vaccine preventable. These observations, combined with my experience as a mother, fashioned how I spoke with my patients, parents, and the media to foster the doctor-patient relationship. It's so important to maintain or attain vaccine coverage for these vaccine-preventable diseases at greater than 95% to control the spread and then eliminate these diseases. Ironically, there's been a slight increase in uptake of immunizations recently, as some parents want their children immunized before they lose their Medicaid coverage or private insurance due to increased cost. As Mark Olshaker and my guest Michael Osterholm wrote in their book, Deadliest Enemy, if we approach science without policy, we will accomplish nothing. Therefore, a consistent science-based immunization policy is so very important. And now on to my recorded interview with Dr. Michael Osterholm. And now to my recorded interview with Dr. Michael Osterholm. August is National Immunization Awareness Month, and I'm speaking with Dr. Osterholm, nationally recognized epidemiologist from the University of Minnesota Center for Infectious Diseases and Policy, known as CDRAP. Welcome to our show, and if there's anything else you want to tell our listening audience, please introduce yourself now.
Well, first of all, thank you very, very much for having me. I'm honored to be here. This is one of my favorite radio stations. We listen in Minneapolis to the station over the internet and happen to have a very special relationship with someone who works there. So it's a special moment for me to be there, and I'm just happy to also be able to be with you today.
Okay, and we're fortunate to have your connection, I guess I'll say.
It's what they say, life is all about connections.
That's correct. Or who you know, or networking is probably the better way to say it. Right? There's so much going on in the news in recent months about the resurgence of vaccine-preventable diseases, especially measles. And now, of course, as we're going into back-to-school season or respiratory virus and bacterial season, I'm sure that influenza, respiratory syncytial virus, whooping cough, or the medical name of pertussis, COVID, and other illnesses will be in the news. The major goal of National Immunization Awareness Month is that the public gets good, reliable, scientifically based information about vaccines and vaccine-preventable diseases. Mike, let's begin with the recent resurgence of measles cases. Tell us what we should know.
Well, first of all, I think it is helpful to take a step back and to help people understand what are vaccines and why are they so important. Well, you know, we've been in a battle with infectious diseases as the human race ever since our very first individuals lived here on the earth, because in fact, even the animal kingdom long before us had to deal with these microbes. And one of the things that we've been gifted to have is an immune system that basically can recognize previous infections with certain bacteria, viruses, parasites, etc. And when we have those infections, we of course pay a price for getting sick. We may become seriously ill, we may die, we may have long-term effects from it, but we oftentimes will develop immunity. So vaccines are all about, well, can we fool the body into making this same kind of immune response that provides us long-term protection without having to go through the illness or being infected? And that was really the genesis of vaccines, those first ones really being for smallpox, where way back, in before the 1700s, individuals recognized that if they could in fact be infected with a smallpox virus via a small abrasion on the arm, as opposed to actually breathing it in, they would get a modified case of illness, but it would be enough to protect them against serious illness and death. And that really started out the world of infectious diseases. And in fact, Washington would tell you that his most famous battle, that was by far the most important of the Civil War or the Revolutionary War, was not that with other individuals, but it was with the smallpox virus. And he actually vaccinated the troops against smallpox using that technique I just mentioned at some peril, because people were afraid what happens if he actually then infects the soldiers and they die. Well, because they now were protected, when they were fighting the Brits, who had all had smallpox earlier in life in the UK, basically ended up being successful. And so it really is a story about how we went on this adventure. And then we figured out, well, there's other infectious diseases like measles, as you mentioned, mumps, rubella, and today even 18 different diseases for which, in fact, we now have figured out how to help fool the body into making the immune response to that particular virus, bacteria, whatever, in such a way that we don't have to get clinically ill, we don't have to be at risk of dying to actually get that protection. So that gets us to where we're at today. Now, some people will tell you that the vaccines themselves are a real problem. And we don't want to for a moment say that every vaccine is perfectly safe. We do have reactions sometimes, in some cases, particularly depending on how people's immune system, what might happen can be in fact quite serious. But if you look at the big picture of vaccines, it has been tremendously positive in terms of saving lives, reducing illness. And the example I would give when I hear people say, well, but somebody, very rarely, but somebody did get a serious reaction. My reaction to that is, imagine the following. I'm driving along in my car one day, and unfortunately, I'm involved in an accident. And guess what? My seatbelt jams. It doesn't come out. And they're trying to extract me from the vehicle as it's on fire. Well, guess what? I didn't get out in time. Well, you'd say, boy, we should stop using seatbelts. And the answer is no, of course not. Because although that was a tragic situation, there are many, 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 many more people who benefit immensely from that seatbelt than the bad outcome that I just talked to you about. Well, vaccines are like that too. We are willing to acknowledge it. In some rare cases, there can be some negative effects. But on the whole, these vaccines save lives. They reduce the likelihood of serious illness, hospitalizations. They reduce the likelihood of having serious side effects like paralysis with polio. And so today, the measles situation really begs the question, what happened? We went through a period of almost 40 years where we had measles vaccines available. They became widely used. We watched in this country alone what we call the elimination of measles, meaning that we didn't have any naturally occurring transmission here. It was only if people were bringing it in from outside the country. To now, one of where we see, we're at 1,300 cases this year alone here in the United States. Canada is even worse right now at about 4,500 cases. And why is that? Well, because of the fact that people aren't getting vaccinated. And they are not getting vaccinated for a variety of reasons, but in many instances, it's not based on the kind of scientifically correct information. And that's what we have a big job to do today, is to help address the issue of vaccine hesitancy so that people do know the benefits and the risks and then can make that wise choice.
Well, that's what, as a pediatrician, I mean, we always number one, obviously said that immunizations were one of the best, you know, public health advances in the last 100 years, or if you count back to smallpox, I guess that's 230 years. But, and that they are very safe. As you said, yes, there are people who have reactions. We've improved the vaccines, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But it's just amazing, all the illnesses, as you said, the 16 to 18 illnesses that we now have some, have good control, or had especially good control until a few years ago. For measles, we all know, or you and I probably know, that in the year 2000, measles was declared eradicated in the United States. And then we had a bit of conversation and a bit of lots of publicity. The sensational publicity is always interesting, how it really affects people's understanding or misunderstanding of public health in general. So that, another question is influenza. I've been reading a little bit about that, seasonal vaccines versus a vaccine that creates longer protection. What do you think, number one, of the influenza season, the prediction for this season, and any comments about the seasonal vaccine versus a longer term vaccine?
Yeah, well, first of all, just want to remind everyone that influenza is a very, very serious disease, even on a seasonal basis, without having it be a pandemic or something in that order. It is one that we can count on happening virtually every winter in each respective hemisphere. So the Southern Hemisphere has their winter during our summer months, but they did develop influenza then. And of course, we have our traditional winter, late November to March time period, where we see influenza circulating. It is a disease that takes a major toll in our society. Just this past year, well over 250 children have died as a result of influenza infection, most of those kids not vaccinated. And it's one where the vaccines that we have are what I call good vaccines. They're not great vaccines, they're good vaccines. And what do I mean by that? Well, one of the things that we'd like to see in all vaccines is what we see, for example, in measles. And what does that mean? That's a vaccine that, when given, literally produces lifelong immunity. And we boost that sometimes with a second dose of vaccine several years later. But the point of it is, it's a very safe vaccine with long, long-term immunity. Well, with influenza, you don't get that long-term immunity. In the situation of how many cases does it prevent from getting infected, it may be very limited, meaning that in a given year, it may be 50 to 60% effective against having to seek medical care. But that is also that same number or higher against hospitalizations and deaths. To me, that's worth a vaccine. Even if I still get infected, I still get sick, but my chances now of becoming seriously ill or dying are greatly reduced. To me, that's a good vaccine. You want to use it. Now, ideally, we want a better vaccine, and our group is very actively working on that. We actually have on our website for our center a major effort we're doing called Vaccine Roadmaps. We're actually tracking very, very carefully what are the additional new research findings we need to get us to long-term vaccines, ones that don't have to be given every year, ones that have ongoing long-term protection. So we're not talking about just reducing serious illness hospitalizations, which, again, I remind everyone, is really a remarkable outcome. But this one actually, like measles, prevents you from getting infected or infecting other people. We're a ways off from that yet. Some would call the next generation vaccines, a universal vaccine, where to protect against many different strains of the flu virus, such as the H1, H2, H3, H5, the different things you've heard about different flu viruses. So I will tell you right now, I would not go a season without getting my flu shot. I get it every year. It is one that may very well not keep me from getting infected, but boy, if it lowers my chances of having serious illness, hospitalization, and death, I'll do it. And so I encourage everyone, and as I just shared with you in kids, people don't know this, but in children in this country, particularly younger kids, their risk of serious illness, hospitalizations, and death with influenza is about the same as it is for those in the 55 to 64-year-old age group. They're almost equivalent. Now, we would never not recommend vaccination for that older age group. We need to recommend it for the younger age group to help reduce the serious illness. And so my hope is that we better use the vaccines we have now. But in addition to that, we need to keep working on exploring how can we get better vaccines. I must say that I am very disappointed that the current administration cut all research funding for looking at how to get better vaccines for flu as it relates to mRNA vaccines, the ones that we talk about with COVID. Why is that important? Well, because in a different world that I live in, where I work on pandemic preparedness, something that everyone's well aware of here on this listening group because of what we've just having gone through COVID. But influenza still remains a very, very real risk for a pandemic, which could be much worse than COVID ever was. And today, given the infrastructure or the capacity we have to manufacture vaccines, we can only make enough vaccine in the world for flu to cover about 2 billion people in 18 months. Well, there's 8 billion people on the face of the earth. That means a lot of people won't have vaccine for years to come. Whereas with the mRNA technology, we could probably get there within 8 to 12 months, enough vaccine for the world. So the fact that this program got cut and is not being supported just shows you, we're penny wise and pound foolish. We desperately, desperately need to have an improved, flu vaccine. So not only just for seasonal flu, but also for pandemic preparedness.
And that's all so interesting because basically the public gets little sound bites, and so they don't always understand how serious the illness is for children or infants especially, and older people. And I also get my seasonal flu vaccine every year, and my family does. Sometimes confusion reigns when the nasal flu was taken off the market for a little while, and then now it's come back. So again, they've worked on it enough that they know that there is good immunity from it now. So I definitely recommend it. And then people always say, "Oh, I always get the flu from the flu shot." It's like you can't do that. That doesn't exist. But there are so many people who think things like that it really takes talking to your doctor or your medical professional, someone that you trust, which is sort of the whole goal of this whole month, is that people should know that they can talk to a medical professional who's going to give you a scientific basis, a good basis for why we are doing the vaccines in general. Then we come to whooping cough and or pertussis is, and I was so glad when the pediatricians were also relieved when the obstetricians finally got on the immunization bandwagon, because they never were good promoters of vaccines. And in the last, I guess my grandson, who's 11, 12 now, when Katie was pregnant with Jack, that was one of the first times it was like, you need to go get your booster. I'd already had my DTaP booster for adults, but now, it's so good that OBs are now promoting these things because they didn't truly do that before. People also don't understand that annoying cough that an adult could have is could be pertussis, and they can give it to very young infants. I had a patient, a nurse whose baby was 5 weeks old, and she had an annoying cough in the winter, and the baby ended up on a breathing machine, a ventilator at Children's Hospital. So I'm sure you have additional information for our listeners.
Well, I think the point to make here is that pertussis is again another one of those diseases that prior to vaccines and prior to antibiotics was unfortunately frequently fatal. And today it's a bacteria, so that in fact if you do get infected, we can still treat you with antibiotics, but the ideal is to use the vaccine. Now, like other infectious diseases, you can get some pretty darn good protection from the pertussis vaccine, but it too lasts for several years at most. And then you are vulnerable again to getting infected. And we're looking carefully at that right now. What should be the schedule of vaccines for pertussis? What does it mean? And as you pointed out in younger children, if you've ever heard a quote unquote whooping cough, you'll never forget it. It is horrible to watch a child struggle to breathe. And I think at that point, that's why, again, you want to vaccinate here. Now, in many cases, people have not seen pertussis as they know it for, much of their lifetime because of the use of vaccines. And they say, well, it's not a risk for me. I don't need to worry about it. Only then becomes a risk when people are not vaccinated. And so, again, I can't say it strongly enough. These childhood vaccines are really critical to assuring the safety of your child and the health of that family.
Well, so interesting when I look at the success of the vaccine program, and then you understand that now our patient parents are young enough that, no, as you mentioned, they don't know any of these diseases or most of the diseases. When I was a resident, Hib meningitis, Haemophilus influenza meningitis, was rampant. And very vividly, I tell the story to my patients, and I was so impressed that the mother of this patient was willing to appear with me on the media and in newspaper reports. But on a Saturday night, a child developed a fever. On Sunday, they had a fever, had a seizure, and had brain damage from Haemophilus influenza meningitis. That was just a year before the vaccine came out. And so, and her child ended up at a facility for children who, were literally severely retarded, severely developmentally delayed or delayed by, injured by this meningitis. And she was willing, as I said, to be interviewed by the newspaper, to be with me on a TV show, how important, how she believed in getting vaccines. And unfortunately, her child was not able to get this vaccine.
You know, I think this is such an important point that you're raising here. I actually was very involved in the research of bringing forward Haemophilus influenzae type B vaccines. And it turned out that early on, the vaccines that we had were not that successful at protecting individuals, and for the following reason, is that much of Haemophilus influenzae type B infection, the meningitis, the brain infection, hearing loss issues, the systemic infection with the bacteria, resulted in a period before your immune system could gear up and actually protect you. And this is what we call, and we get into the things about T cells, whether you have, it needs T cells or it doesn't. Well, T cells don't age in a way that mature to where, how they most are most functional till often 18 or 24 months of life. And so we would see all of these infections that were life-threatening with Haemophilus in the younger age group, under 18 to 24 months. Well, the first vaccines didn't do much better in those younger age groups. They surely provided more protection for the older age groups, but it was a younger group we need. Then we were involved with researching a new type of vaccine called a conjugate vaccine, where basically there was another molecule linked up with the part that would cause your body to produce the antibodies to the bacteria, and this additional the molecule then made the immune system recognize it, even though that hadn't matured yet. And when that thing came along, it revolutionized overnight pediatric infectious disease care. And as you pointed out, I too had seen many. And in fact, I did very active surveillance in the state of Minnesota for a number of years before and after the vaccines were introduced. And there was a period just before the vaccines were introduced in Minnesota where a child, by the time they reached the age of 4, had a 1 in 200 chance of having a life-threatening severe influenza infection. 1 in 200. I mean, that's high. And so we revolutionized this with these new vaccines. Well, what's happening? We're starting to see Haemophilus influenzae pick up again. Not a lot, but guess what it is? It's in the unvaccinated, the same thing that we've been talking about. So if I didn't think that that was an important disease because I'd never seen it, I can understand that. But we're telling you, we have seen it. We're telling you what it'll look like if, in fact, something's not done to protect your child. And that's the hard message we have is, we're selling wellness in a way that people say, well, I feel well now. They don't understand the risk of what can happen in that kind of a setting. And Haemophilus influenzae type B is such a horribly painful acknowledgement of that issue.
Well, in general, the fact that we have three vaccines now for bacterial meningitis is so interesting because the news would make people think meningitis is only Neisseria meningitidis because they'll publicize a college child, college student who thought they had the flu, and suddenly they're taken to the emergency room, absolutely, so sick that, and some don't even survive. The fact now that we have the Hib, Haemophilus influenza, pneumococcal meningitis, and Neisseria meningococcus is so reassuring to me and to us, to people in the medical profession. But again, that's where we have to educate the public that these are three different, very serious bacterial illnesses.
And if I could add a comment here, because I think you've laid that out very, very nicely. One of the challenges we have is you think it's never going to happen to me until it does. And I think that's one of the real problems is that that logic, you may say, is acceptable. If I'm an adult, I know fully what the risks are. I understand this is the possibility that could happen to me if I don't get vaccinated. And this is how I'd be protected if I did. But where I find it really challenging, these are young kids. They're in our care. These are the kids that we're responsible for. Would we put them in the back seat of our car with no car seat, no seat belt, and drive through red lights at 40 miles an hour with them in the back seat? People would look and say, how irresponsible that is. Now, I'm not sitting here talking to parents and saying they're irresponsible. That would be the last thing I want to say in terms of engaging them. But they have to understand that there are consequences to these decisions. So what we need to do today is listen to them and ask them, why are you against vaccines? What is it? Really try to learn and understand what they're up against. And then at that point, then share the information that we have to say why we think their vaccines are so important. And I think we have too many stalemates right now where one calls out the other one and says, look at how horrible they are. And the other one calls out the other one and says, look how horrible they are. And I think that we have a lot of work to do to try to get through that issue and to be able to actually have conversations as opposed to shouting at each other.
It's interesting too, now that adults are getting the pneumonia shot. It's like, it's the pneumococcal shot, which happens to cause pneumonia. But all, there's so many adults that call it the pneumonia shot, which I call it. You need just a little bit more information. Let's go a little bit to COVID, because COVID will rear its ugly head again, perhaps. I guess I don't really know. What's your prediction for fall and winter of 25?
Well, COVID incidence in our community is really tied to two totally different factors. One is, what is your status in terms of immunity? When's the last time you had COVID? When's the last COVID shot you had? And as I pointed out earlier, immunity wanes over time. Now, by waning, it may mean that you have a higher likelihood now than you did 4 months ago of getting ill, but we still see a persistent protection that occurs against hospitalizations and deaths. So I just want to keep coming home to that, saying that I hear people criticize the vaccine. So I'm not going to get that one because look at, I could still get infected with it. That's true. But you also then want to have some protection against seriously ill. That to me is a priceless part of that. Now, in terms of the second part of the issue of what's going to happen, whether there's immunity or not, is how well does the vaccines actually protect against new strains? And the new strains are what this is all about, meaning that just like we see with influenza, from year to year to year, we have to get a new flu shot. Why? Because the virus has changed. These are very, very, you might call them robust viruses that in a given year can change substantially from the year before. Well, COVID's exactly the same way. There's new variants that we call that actually can change enough that too causes less protection and in terms of immunity, because the new virus is different enough from the last one I got infected with or the last one I got vaccinated for. And so when you get the waning immunity in the population combined with a new variant, you can start to see sizable increases in cases again. Now, again, as I pointed out, I would hope most people would have milder illness just because enough people would have had COVID before or been previously vaccinated. But at the same time, it still can cause a problem in the community. We're beginning to see here in the United States, some communities are starting to show some increased incidence of COVID. I can tell you that for the last 4 to 5 months in southern China, in the areas around Hong Kong and so forth, there was a fair amount of COVID that occurred. Fortunately, it was limited in terms of the amount of fatal cases. But this time, as you may recall, in those early days of COVID, remember when we lost our smell? We couldn't smell it because the virus affected basically the nerves in the head where smell would be picked up and processed. Well, now we have a new kind of culprit, and that is one where it's called razor blade throats. And people are reporting over and over again in these countries, sore throats that are so severe, people feel like somebody's taking razor blades to their throats. That's how it got its term. That's not a good thing to get. So again, from a vaccine standpoint, it would be great that you didn't have to experience that if you'd been vaccinated. And so we'll see what happens with COVID. I think we're going to see a winter where it's coming back, but it won't be ever as bad as it was 5 years ago, 4 years ago. But it still could really be a challenge.
It's so interesting because people go, well, I had COVID, so I don't need one of those new shots. I only got 2 shots. And I'm going,
yeah.
Goodness, I've had 7, I think. I mean,
well, you know, I know people who have actually had COVID as a clinical illness 3 different times.
Yeah.
And well, each one of them wanes over time. They don't have it right away. You know, if I've just had COVID, there's a good chance that I'm going to be protected for a while, but not that long.
Well, no. And now that we have gone several years, I guess that's your one of the, I won't call it ammunition because that sounds pretty strict. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that when people say, well, I'm not going to get another one of those shots, it's like, well, but now it's been 3 years or whatever since you've had the disease. So I really would think that a vaccine would be helpful to you.
Yep. Absolutely. Yep.
Well, that brings us to the American Academy of Pediatrics, American Family Practice, ACOG, the Society for Fetal Internal Maternal Medicine lawsuit, mainly because they, as a quote, we will not stay silent on vaccines and immunizations save lives, because the ACIP said they're not going to recommend COVID for healthy children and pregnant women. So what are your comments about that?
Well, first of all, let me just be really clear to the audience here. You know, I've now been in this business 50 years. I've been at the University of Minnesota that entire time, as well as 25 years at the Minnesota Department of Health, where I had worked at both places. While I was at the Minnesota Department of Health, I worked for 2 different Republican governors, 2 Democratic governors. And if anybody knows anything about our state of Minnesota with Jesse Ventura, I worked for 1 independent wrestler. And no one could tell you my partisan politics. I served all of them as a private in the public health army. I've had a role in every presidential administration dating back to Ronald Reagan, where I was involved with the HIV/AIDS Commission back in the 80s. And during the Trump 1 administration, I was a science envoy for the State Department going around the world, trying to get us better prepared for a pandemic. I was on the Biden-Harris transition team for COVID. And again, no one could tell you my partisan politics. I was all about, you know, protecting the public's health. So when I comment on these things, please know that I'm commenting not as a politician or a political voice. This is just the facts. Kind of divided out of, for those few of us that are old enough to remember the old Dragnet program, when Joe Friday would look at the individual and say, just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. Okay. You know, that's kind of how I see my role today. So what do I think about what's happening? Well, first of all, to me, it's unconscionable what we're seeing happen with our oversight of vaccines in this country, with a Secretary of Health and Human Services that is an avowed anti-vaccine person, and who has spent many of his recent years working to basically get vaccines off the market, in a sense. And what's recently happened is he just unilaterally decided, despite promising Senator Bill Cassidy from Louisiana, the senator that got him through, that he wouldn't take vaccines away. Well, he is. He's taking them away from pregnant women and from young children right now. So the Academy of Pediatrics was a lead. They basically filed a lawsuit against the administration, saying that they could not just unilaterally take vaccines off the market like that without going through the normal review process, getting input from expert organizations that are all part of that review process. And Mr. Kennedy, in a 58-second X to script, basically said, "I'm doing it. Here it is, read my lips," kind of thing. Okay. And so they filed a lawsuit and said, "You can't do that." Well, first of all, I have nothing but the highest regard for these organizations. I am so we're so blessed to have them really fighting for you as citizens. The problem is with this lawsuit, we could lose. And if we lose, there have been legal scholars that have opined on this and said, wow, that would then give the secretary the kind of power that, we talk about today with the president, where he's immune from anything he does in his job as long as he's doing his job. Mr. Kennedy could have carte blanche on what to do with vaccines. He could take any vaccine off the market, and it would, in fact, be legal to do that. So I worry about this one a lot in terms of where it's going. If we get a successful decision on it, then you have to know, well, what's going to be the next one? Because it's going to get appealed all the way to the Supreme Court. And we've seen how the Supreme Court has so far handled most of these. They've been very favorable to the administration, these kinds of rulings. So I worry that in a few months, we could be sitting in a situation where the Secretary of Health and Human Services can decide all by himself what is going to happen or not happen with vaccines. I think that would be a travesty.
Oh, definitely. If it's mainly to emphasize the scientific reason behind the fact that the new recommendations are not going to support healthy children and pregnant women, that's one thing. But as you said, if the lawsuit or does not succeed, then that does give carte blanche to the secretary and the advisory committee on immunization practices. Whatever the ACIP does too affects not only the public understanding, but also what doctors will feel comfortable giving and insurance companies will pay for, and Medicaid and the Vaccine for Children program. So it's a whole very complicated, ball of whatever, wax.
And I think that really speaks to the issue that you and I have had discussions on, is we're heading up an activity right now called the Vaccine Integrity Project. And our whole point about that is that we no longer find any scientific credibility in the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP. It doesn't exist. He fired all 17 members of that organization who are outside experts with full disclosures of conflicts, inability to vote on things that might have any overlaying implications for the individual expert. And so that we lost a great deal of that scientific expertise. He then appointed eight people, which one left, to the new ACIP, of which at least six of them are avowed anti-vaccine individuals. And so at this point, the ACIP lacks any credibility to make recommendations that anybody would actually use and accept. So we took it upon ourselves to say, well, wait a minute. One of the actually important work efforts of the ACIP is to do the kinds of intensive review of all the literature, of all the research out there that says, what is the safety? What is the protection level? How effective are these vaccines? And what data do we have to support their use? And so we took it upon ourselves as part of the Vaccine Integrity Project to actually do that work ourselves. And we have a team of over 20 some people working on this around the clock right now, so that we can then provide the portfolio brief overviewing each of these vaccines to the respective organizations that we just mentioned earlier. They're the ones that will be making the recommendations for how vaccines are to be used. So we're not the ACIP. We never will be the ACIP. But can we serve in a auxiliary role that is scientifically sound and one, therefore, that the payers could accept? Well, some of the states have laws that require ACIP data to be used to purchase vaccines for individuals. That those states are looking at that right now because they would be hamstrung by, the current recommendations based on a non-scientific review. The other thing that's happening with this is the fact that we are working with payers. We're talking to payers to say, could we use this as a alternative source of information to allow you to say, we'll pay for these vaccines? Remember, people may have whatever feelings they have about insurance companies, but it's interesting. One of the areas that is clearly in their favor is they don't want kids to get vaccine for those diseases. They cost money. They can be very costly. So it's actually cheaper for them to vaccinate kids. Okay. And so from that standpoint, there's no financial incentive not to get kids vaccinated. So if payers can actually find a way from a legal perspective to let the data be used that we're generating, then they should be home free in terms of making sure that these vaccines are available. And so that's what we're working on right now. We have a very active program in this area. We're working closely with the manufacturers. We're working closely with the societies so that we know basically what they're intending to do with their vaccine recommendations and hopefully do a major workaround what has happened so far with the vaccine situation at our federal level, knowing all along that the most important thing we can do is get back to business as usual. These groups, the Vaccine Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, the FDA Committee on Vaccines, et cetera, they've all functioned really, really well. They're the last things that we should have been tearing down, but they are. Now we just have to do what we can to help supplement them.
And I know I've been asked to be on an insurance company board and advisory committee, so they do try. They're trying to get the best information, but unfortunately, that takes time sometimes. I remember when HPV came in, and one of the big insurers in Columbus, Ohio, had not yet put it on their panel. So I was like, well, if you have this insurance, you might have to pay this much. But we all, gave the reasons for you'd want to have a vaccine that prevents cancer, which was totally, amazing.
And
So,
we have vaccines that do that.
now we do. So, well, I'm really looking forward to hearing the successes of the Vaccine Integrity Project, because it's certainly an important group that you have put together. Talk a little bit why people become vaccine resistant or vaccine hesitant, and how to combat the misinformation. It is interesting. It's the art of the soundbite, or what I call, the sensationalism. And sometimes I think the anti-sensationalism gets more listeners. And now, of course, they're recycling old news about thimerosal and autism, which were discussed 20 years ago, 25 years ago, and were put to rest. So, any other comments about how we can combat the anti-sensationalism, or just
Well,
the stories like I was telling?
one of the areas that we're also pursuing with the Vaccine Integrity Project is to immediately address mis and disinformation. So we've assembled a group of experts that will, in a very timely way, climb on top of these issues and in succinct ways lay out, wait a minute, what's really happening here? What does this mean? And in a way that the public can understand. And of course, it'll be there also for the clinical community so that they too can understand. One of the challenges we have, well, let me just give you an example of how something like this happens. Thimerosal is a derivative product that basically helps protect vaccine vials from getting contaminated if you have multiple use vials, meaning if you're in a rural area somewhere, you need a vaccine that basically you're not going to use up that one day. You may not use it up for 5 days, and you want to put it back in the refrigerator after every time you've used one, okay? And so what thimerosal has done is actually helped make that happen. Now, it's a form of mercury, but it's a form of mercury that is not harmful to humans. It's methyl mercury. It's ethyl mercury that is harmful to humans, okay? And to say that because you're consuming methyl mercury and i.e. thimerosal is in a sense saying that basically if I'm a human, all fluids are dangerous. I can't drink gasoline and I can't drink water. No, there's a big difference between water and gasoline, okay? And so that's the difference between ethyl and methyl mercury. Well, what's happened is that the scientific community basically has been faced with the new ACIP taking thimerosal out of vaccines, which only about 4% of influenza vaccines came in thimerosal containing units for their long-term use. They've now made the claim, see, look what we did. We finally protected you. We took this off the market. Well, they took it off the market, but it doesn't provide any new protection whatsoever. But it gave people the sense, oh my gosh, they didn't tell us the truth. Here they've been giving this vaccine out all this time, and look how dangerous it is. And so I think at this point, that's the kind of thing that you want to get out right away and say, no, the thimerosal issue was totally a misrepresentation of what was happening, and there is no danger from it. And specifically, it actually helped save doses for individuals so that they didn't become contaminated with the bacteria that might get introduced every time you inject the needle in. That's the kind of mis and disinformation that they will use, and they've done that and will continue to do that, and we have to stand up to that.
A long time ago, it might have been 20 years ago, it's the only reporter I ever hung up on because he told me that somebody reported to him that every time you got an influenza dose, the mercury content was going to, accumulate in your body. And I gave him all the studies like you were just recently talking about. And finally I had to say, sir, I have a patient waiting for me in the next room. I think I'm going to have to end our conversation. Because I just couldn't get through with what I felt was the truth. So, well, that brings
Well,
us to vaccine development and the ethics of vaccine studies and the phases of clinical trials. It was Robert Kennedy again that said that vaccines are not well tested, but someone you know, Jake Scott, he's a doctor at Stanford, I think,
yep, he's a
researching all of the randomized clinical trials regarding vaccines. And noted that essentially every vaccine has been tested in placebo-controlled trials of some sort. So then we have to help the public understand what those trials are. Our practice would participate in vaccine trials, and we were usually involved in studying or measuring the immunity or the non-inferiority if there was a combination vaccine versus the individual shots. So we wanted to, the company was asking us, we were part of a research group that you might get a Hib and a saline shot, or you got a Hib with a DPT. So they could actually combine the Hib DPT. So tell us a little bit about your ideas about that. I'm sure you have them.
Well, first of all, there's very few things that you can invest in right now that'll have a higher payback than vaccines. Again, I realize that we hope this doesn't happen often, but we just went through one, so we understand it really can be devastating. And that is, in fact, the idea of another pandemic. The best way we have of assuring that we can respond to a pandemic in a very effective way is to have safe and effective vaccines ready to go. And so at this point, that's one cause. But it is a kind of a double plus if those same vaccines can be used to prevent seasonal disease. So now we don't even worry about influenza or COVID if, in fact, people get vaccinated because they are very effective in reducing that situation too. So you get a kind of a two for one kind of benefit. Well, you'd want to invest a lot more in flu vaccines. One is we don't do that. The first thing we do is we typically do it from a basis of year-to-year funding. Okay. Imagine today a 15-year life is what it takes to bring forward a new aircraft carrier. 15 years it takes. When they start building that aircraft carrier, they fund it from the very beginning. They don't make them come back to Congress every year and have to fight for funding to finish the next stage of the aircraft carrier. Well, with us, influenza is very much the same way. COVID is the same way. We need vaccines that we can do the research on over the next 10 years to give us the best chance of getting one of these game-changing vaccines. We don't do that. We just don't. And right now, as I've mentioned earlier, this administration has pulled all of its resources out of trying to find new vaccines, particularly with those that are what we call the mRNA technology that we saw during COVID. We need these desperately. We need these desperately. And right now, unfortunately, I have to say that it's one where we're not going to have these vaccines anytime soon.
Well, it's interesting. The ethics too of to understand vaccine trials is if you have a vaccine, I can't not give you that vaccine. So I can't do placebo versus DPT because I have a DPT. So you would do old DPT versus new DPT, or basically the same combination.
I think that's an important point. Placebo-controlled trials are actually really important when you're testing it against something that doesn't exist, meaning there is no new vaccine. This is it. But when you have a pre-existing vaccine available, and you're trying to find, does this one make it better? Is this an improvement? Just go look at what happens with cancer research. You don't stop putting people on cancer drugs looking at new research. You add them on. Some people get the standard drug plus the new one. Some get the standard drug without the new one, but they don't know which. That's standard practice. It's the only ethical way you can do it. Well, the same thing is true with the vaccines. And so when they say that placebo-controlled trials have not been done, that's just simply not true. Now, if you're going to require a trial to be one where half the people got nothing and half the people got vaccinated, that's as unethical as it could be. And so I don't even know how we end up debating this part of the question, because to me, it's just so obvious. You can't deny somebody the basic care. What you want to find out is, can you do better than the basic care? Can you do better than the basic protection? And that's what we need to keep promoting. And as you noted, Jake Scott, who's a dear, dear friend and colleague, did this very detailed research to look at just how many placebo-controlled trials are out there. Every vaccine we have today has had a double-blind placebo-controlled trial plus additional new trials when we're comparing about even a better vaccine against a previous vaccine.
Now, there's so many phases of vaccine trials too. There's so much that the public probably doesn't know, I guess. And sometimes it's we can explain it all, and sometimes it's just to say that vaccines have been well studied over several years. There's so much to talk about on the immunization front, and it's fascinating to me that there is so much controversy, especially since vaccines have been improved so much over the years. I mean, we didn't just take cowpox and scratch skin. We're really working on purifying all these vaccines. So, as I know, the DPT, the whole cell DPT, was irritating. People did get fevers. We always have an anecdotal story of a lady who, a mom who said, "I'm not going to give my child a shot today because we're driving to North Carolina or we're driving somewhere on vacation." And the child still had a virus, had a fever, had a seizure. If the child had had the shot, she would have blamed the shot. So the DAPT, the acellular pertussis, was certainly a big advance. I know we've talked about the antigens in it, but I'll let you do the talking about that.
Well, I think the bottom line message is that we have made the vaccines more refined, in a sense, cleaner than any time. If you had old vaccines, you might have gotten thousands of different antigens, different pieces of something that would cause your body's immune system to respond. Today, we have fewer antigens in all the combined shots we get than we used to have in an old dose of diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis vaccine, meaning that we've continued to make these vaccines safer and safer and more likely to not cause side effects. When you got the old pertussis vaccine, there was so much additional material in there we didn't really need, that in fact it often led to people having some really sore arms or feeling feverish, needing to go to bed for it. We've done so much to eliminate that. And so I think it's fair to say today this is not even an issue or a question that should be brought up. What's going on with antigens? Yet you'll hear people exaggerate and say, oh, if my body's going to take in all this stuff, how can it handle it? What's going to happen? And in a sense, even if we had vaccines that had a lot of these different antigens in them, we hardly cover even a very, very small percent of our immune system's response capacity. So it's just a non-issue, but for the public, it's a scary issue.
And another non-issue is, again, measles, mumps, rubella, and chickenpox, varicella, used to be given individually. And then parents really wanted to, they liked the combination vaccines because their child could get three less shots. And then all of a sudden, the combination vaccines became the basically the villain. So
and of note, the combination vaccines were made it more likely for people to get vaccinated because they felt like, oh, if I can get this one and not have to get three additional shots. And the studies were done to show that, in fact, these vaccines provided equal protection to however they administered it. What an advantage to administer that.
Without increased side effects.
Right, so. Exactly. Yep.
Well, we're coming to the end of our time. So I just want to do a quote that I came across in a book by Neil deGrasse Tyson. He wrote, "The good thing about science is that it's true, whether or not you believe in it."
Well, you know, I always remind people that science is the pursuit of truth. It's not truth. It's the pursuit of truth. And we're always going to be learning. We're always going to be learning something new. And we then have to incorporate that into what we know. And we shouldn't see learning new things as a bad thing. We should see learning new things as a growth, as something that's positive. And one of the things that we're very committed to in our work and others like us are also is we'll always tell you the truth. We'll tell you what we know and what we don't know. We'll tell you how we know what we know. And if we don't know it, what we're going to do to try to find out. And so I think that's the whole measure here of truth. We're pursuing it all the time.
Yeah, some people become frustrated, like when some new thing comes out. Well, why didn't I get that? It's like, well, because it hadn't been studied. I mean, think about the human genome. When I did chromosome work in the 1960s, I could only look at 46, you know, paper doll kind of looking things.
And yeah.
Genes on every one of those chromosomes. Well, I want to give you, Dr. Michael Osterholm, a sincere thank you for sharing your extensive knowledge about vaccines and vaccine-preventable diseases. Please, for the listening public, review your immunization records and, of course, those of your children. Discuss your concerns with your primary care physician and be honest. They can help you understand why these vaccines are one of the biggest improvements in public health in the last 100, 200, 230 years. And thank you all for listening to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne. Please do remember that this is a medical information show. It does not substitute for discussing your concerns with your medical provider. Please tune in next month on September 1st when we'll be talking about yoga and the mind-body connection with a yoga instructor and a practitioner. This is 88.5 KRFY, community radio for North Idaho.